Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode here on the Wayward Podcast, where the word paves the way. My name is Jonathan Robinson, and I am going to be your conversational buddy or host for the day. If this is your first time joining here on the podcast, I just want to welcome you. Thank you for giving me a portion of your time, and I hope what you hear today will be educational and encouraging. And if you like what you hear, I would really love it if you subscribed to wherever it is you get your podcasts. And if you are a returning listener, I really want to just say welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in once again, and I hope that what you are hearing, what you have been hearing, has been encouraging. I know that I am posting this particular episode a day or two later than I would normally like to. A lot of that was just due to the content being a little bit more expanded than I had originally thought it would be, but I wanted to take the time to make sure that everything got into today's discussion, and so that kind of meant pushing things a little bit back, or pushing things back a little bit more. So I apologize if you have been sitting around your computer or phone waiting for the next episode to drop. But hopefully what you hear will be encouraging and helpful. So thank you very much for joining. We've been doing a Bible story series for a while, and a part of that Bible story series that we've been doing it's been focusing on Genesis chapter 1. And the last couple of weeks, I have been focusing on the creation story, Genesis chapter 1. And we've been going through the days of creation in that story, and we've been exploring what functions God gave order to within creation. And if you look at it, if you look at the creation story, days 1 through 3 are structured as days of forming. On day 1, God established the function of time. On day 2, we explored the function of weather being established. And on day 3, all the moving parts there enabled the life cycle of vegetation to commence. And so that is kind of a very quick summary of days 1 through 3, days of forming. And I really encourage you to go back and listen to all those episodes, you know, so you can get kind of a sense of the bigger picture. Following that, days 4 through 6, these days are structured as days of filling. And the functions that were established in the first 3 days, they form the basis that sustains what the next 3 days will bring forth and fill. And there is a parallelism and a correlation between the first set of 3 days and the second set of 3 days. On day 1, God established time, but then parallel to that, on day 4, God appointed the lights in the sky to act as functionaries of time, allowing for time to be measured and discerned. And on day 2, God appointed the separation of the sky and the seas to establish the function of weather. But then, correlating with that, on day 5, God charged the birds in the sky and the creatures in the sea to be fruitful and multiply and soar and swim against the chaos that is often associated with those particular environments. And since today we will be exploring day 6, let's just quickly recall that on day 3, the waters separated, the lands emerged, and the soil enabled the life cycle of vegetation to commence, establishing an environment that was sustainable and livable. Okay? But for whom? Well, that is what we were going to explore today. So if you want to follow along in your Bibles, I am reading from Genesis chapter 1, verses 24 through 25. So there, I just cleared my throat with a nice glass of water, nice sip of water, and we are off. Verse 24. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things, and wild animals of the earth of every kind. And it was so. Verse 25. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. So in verses 24 through 25, a new kind of functionary is brought forth. They are similar in nature to the functionaries that were brought forth on day 5, but slightly different. They are living creatures, but they are bound to the dry lands of earth. Professor of Old Testament and Near Eastern Studies, Dr. John Walton, who I have been regularly citing throughout this study, just because of his insightful views on the creation story, he makes a very interesting point here that in verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures. It is not scientific in nature, but the line is intended as a simple indication of the locational origins of these creatures. It's kind of similar to, you know, to simply saying that cheese comes from Wisconsin. You know, the text is not real. When the text says, let the earth bring forth living creatures, it's not making a scientific statement. It's talking about, or it's making a kind of a reference. It's like, let the creatures that are known for these regions come forth from these regions. It's kind of an origin statement. So it's not a process statement or a statement about how these animals are produced, but a locational statement. These are the kinds of creatures that you can expect in this dry land environment. They are wild animals. They are herd animals. They are smaller creeping creatures, from the very big to the very small. And in a neat moment of parallelism, just how day 3 saw the putting forth of every plant according to its kind, now here, on day 6, every animal, according to its kind, is brought forth. So the life-giving function of day 3 establishes an energy that would prepare the environment for these animals to be at home. Now, something I notice is absent here, unlike the previous day, is a specific blessing upon these earthbound animals. Whereas in verse 22, God blessed the birds and the sea creatures and commanded them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth, we don't specifically see that similar blessing and command on these earthbound creatures. Now, does that mean that these earthbound creatures are not blessed? Well, not necessarily. Now, I could be wrong, but I think there might be two possible explanations that could be interacting with each other. First, it's quite possible and likely that God's blessing upon the living creatures in day 5 carries over and extends also to these living creatures that emerge on day 6. Now, I've already mentioned how because of the life-giving or the life-cycling function formed on day 3, this environment already has the energy that would make it hospitable and sustainable for these living creatures to thrive. So my thought is that I'm thinking the blessing of day 5 extends itself to them, to give function to their role upon the earth. Okay? But a second, additional possible explanation for what also serves to bless the living creatures can be understood in what comes next. So let's look at what comes next. It's in verse 26. The entire creation story in Genesis chapter 1 has been building to this particular moment. So if I sound emphatic, it is because that this is kind of, we are getting here in verse 26, we are getting into what is or what could be considered to be the centerpiece of the creation story, okay? So verse 26, here we go. Then God said, "Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So like I said, this passage, it's getting into the big centerpiece of creation. But before we get into that, to first, in order to finish our point that I was making, or that we were talking about with the animals, while the living creatures in the sky and the sea and on the dry land are blessed by God to exist on their own, to exist as their own functionaries, to be fruitful and to multiply in their respective environments, verse 26 seems to augment or extend the living creature's functionary role through the humans God creates to rule over them, meaning that it is a part of their role upon the earth, a part of these animals' role upon the earth to be ruled by the humans. Why? Well, before we answer that, let's pause to really be introduced to these human creatures. So in verse 26, we've already read that. God says, "Let us make humans in our image, and let them have dominion over all the living creatures." So we've touched upon how ruling over living creatures is one of humankind's functionaries, but there is another aspect of their role that we must turn to, because it is pretty much, like I said, the central part of this text. The humans' rule over the living creatures is a role that is contingent on them being made in the image and the likeness of God. Apart from ruling the living creatures, it's not yet exactly clear what that means, but in verse 27, an entire repetitious pattern is given to dwell on the idea. So look at verse 27, if you wish. In verse 27, the text reads, "So God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." So it has been debated whether or not this verse here is poetry or prose set within an already carefully structured text. But one thing that is clear is that one singular idea is being emphasized and reiterated. Okay? Now, the first two sentences in verse 27 are what is called a chiasmus, which is a literary structure where a statement is made in one sentence, and in the next sentence, the statement is repeated, but in reverse order. And one of the purposes for this kind of chiasmus structure, according to Patricia Leisner, who's a university grammar professor, One of the purposes for this kind of chiasmus structure is to give the impression to the readers that the entire argument has been accounted for. In other words, what is being asserted is true and final. And that's significant, considering that the one singular idea the text is asserting and settling here is that humankind is to be understood as beings created in the image of God. And with that idea asserted and understood, the third line in this verse gives it a bit more dimension, clarifying that it is both male and female humans who are created in God's image. Now, why does this gender distinction figure into this image of God idea? Because this gender distinction is crucial to their purpose. Okay? In verse 28, the text continues by saying, God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So similar to how God blessed the living creatures in verse 22, here, God now blesses the humans. And similar to how God's blessing conferred upon the living creatures a special function, here, the same function and role is conferred upon the humans as God tells them to be fruitful and multiply. But that's only part of the function that they are blessed with. The humans are then blessed with an additional function. Not only are they to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, they are also to subdue it and have dominion over it. They are to have dominion over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and the beasts of the earth. Now, in a previous episode, I mentioned how the appearance of God's blessing is a new development to the scriptural story, and how by drawing closer to creation, it demonstrates God embodying a new expression of intimacy. And so now, with this blessing and ruling function God has conferred upon the humans, it appears God has taken yet another intimate step towards his creation. But not just merely creation, the centerpiece of creation. God is relating to these humans more intimately than anything else that has been given function thus far. And we see this as we continue into the next, continue in the text, because in verse 29, God seems to be personally introducing humankind to creation. In verse 22, we back a little ways, we saw God speak at the living creatures, but here in verse 29, we see God speak with the humans. In verse 29, God said, see, or behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, and everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. So in speaking with the humans, God is intimately introducing them to their home. See? Behold. Now all these vegetable plants and fruit trees, they are yours to eat. And all these birds and living creatures, they will eat the green plants as well. And so basically what we kind of see here is that God is welcoming them to this grand ecosystem of life, providing for them and commissioning them to rule it well, to take care of creation. And that kind of gives us the answer that I was talking about a few minutes ago about how it is a part of the living creature's role upon the earth to be ruled by the humans, because the humans have been equipped with a special function that works in the best interests of the living creatures. For these living creatures to have the living images of God ruling over them, that is an indication that these animals are being cared for, that their functionary is not going to be given to chaos, but they are going to be ruled over and ruled well. They are going to be ruled by creatures that God has given to them to rule over them and to care for them. That's the plan, at least. And so with that said, the text concludes in verse 31, where God saw everything that he had made. And indeed, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. And so now, having made our way through this day six text, the question that can help us bring it all together might be, what do these human functionaries mean for the story? And I think we will best be able to answer that by further exploring what the image of God means. So we'll start with that, okay? All right. Conversations about the image of God can go in a lot of different directions with a lot of different ideas put forth and suggested. Now, in the past and in past writings or messages, I've done a couple of messages on the image of God in the past, and I've kind of arrived at a variety of different conclusions, some of which I think can eventually be taken into account, applied, and appreciated. But at this point in my understanding of the idea, I think it is best to do what I've been trying to do throughout this study, and that is to go back to how the idea was held in these ancient times. And so, just to be clear, the source that I'm citing from is at this, you know, in the thing, in the immediate things that I say here, I'm citing from theologian Michael Byrd and his book, Seven Things I Wish Christians Knew About the Bible. It's a really good book. It's really quick, concise, detailed, meaty. And so, yeah, it's a great book to read if you're wanting to review what our relationship to the Bible can be as believers. And so, but in that book, he kind of gets into this very topic. And while talking about this, Michael Byrd actually cites from different sources as well, sources of theologians and scholars, which include David Kleins, Walter Brueggemann, Victor Hamilton, and J. Richard Middleton. And what it basically comes down to is the idea that in the ancient Near East, the image of God was a special phrase or an exalted title that was reserved for monarchs, okay? As special earthly servants of the gods, kings of the nations were viewed as those who bore the image of the gods. And so they were kind of traditionally given the title, or it was one of the titles that was given to refer to them, but as the image of God. And this can be seen with the Egyptian pharaohs. This can be also seen with the Assyrian kings, and this kind of goes outside our purview right now, but you can also see it with some of the Greeks and also with some of the Roman emperors, but that's a different discussion. Related, but different. But so with this ancient Near Eastern context in view, it is very probable that Genesis 1, 26 through 27 is designating humans as royalty, as God's representative rulers of creation. God is the rightful ruler of creation, but these human beings are God's vice regents of creation. It's like they are stewards, royal stewards. They speak and act with the authority of God and the way that they care for creation, and the way that they rule creation, and the way that they interact with creation. It's like seeing them act is like seeing God act. Thus, you know, that's kind of the where we get the phrase, they seeing them is like beholding the image of God. So how this understanding of the image of God helps clarify or inform the functionary role of the humans is by framing the male and female humans as God's king and queen of creation. And I think this idea is made pretty clear in the language that is used when God blesses and commissions the humans. Because in both verses 26 and 28, God says that they are to have dominion over, or to rule over the birds and the living creatures. And so this ruler language aligns well with how the image of God title was used in the ancient Near East. So with this understanding of the image of God in view, here now are a couple of ideas for what the functional role of these humans might mean for the story. Okay. First, the image of God describes the human's privileged status and functional role in the creation story. The humans are the last to be given function in the creation story in Genesis 1, but they are also featured as the centerpiece of creation. If we look back at the story and the structure of the previous 5 days, we can see how it was an environment being fitted together, formed and filled to become livable and hospitable for various living creatures, the humans being the foremost of them all. And when they finally arrive on the scene, the text uses the language of divine royalty to describe them, or more contextually, to describe their function. So, since with great privilege or great power comes great responsibility, as the saying goes, the image of God phrase is not just a title, but it is something of a job description. Second, the humans project God's image through their male and female gender. Now, if we look back through Genesis 1 carefully, the language of reproduction is everywhere. Whether talking about seeds and plants, different plants after their own kind, or the earth bringing forth living creatures after their kind, or animals being fruitful and multiplying, Genesis 1 is really emphasizing how reproduction is a significant key to making the life cycle dynamics of this environment energetically and sustainably thrive. And by explicitly identifying the humans as male and female genders, the text is now focusing on the way in which the humans possess the power to propel these life cycle dynamics forward. And that way is by being the male and female image bearers of God. Third, the humans project God's image by multiplying themselves throughout creation. As male and female image bearers of God, humans are empowered to pass the image of God down through reproduction. But that capacity to pass it on only happens if the humans actually multiply. So, as empowered and instructed, the humans embody the function of filling by participating and multiplying themselves, by participating in the propelling of life. Fourth, the humans project God's image by ruling over creation. Now, at this point, the text doesn't really get into the specifics of ruling or having dominion over creation, except to say that as the male and female image bearers of God, fruitfully multiplying and filling creation, it is their responsibility to rule. There is more that could be said and will be said in the future to clarify this responsibility of ruling, but right now, the Genesis 1 text is primarily focused on establishing that the responsibility of ruling creation is a primary part of being a human being, made in the image of God. So these are just a couple of ideas for what the functional role of these humans might mean for the story. And like I said, there are more details to explore later, but for now, their functionary role has been established in creation. And, you know, I was just kind of thinking about, as I was preparing this, I was just trying to think about, you know, how we might internalize this whole idea. And my mind kind of went back to the C.S. Lewis's book, his famous book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And if you're familiar with that book, or if you're not familiar with that book, ultimately, these four children, they enter into a wondrous, magical land, and they liberate it through the help of Aslan, the Christ-like figure lion, and they liberate it from the clutches of the Wicked White Witch. And at the end of the story, they are enthroned. And then at some point in the story, they are considering, you know, going back to their own land, where they will be returned to like a kind of a human form. I might be getting the chronology of different parts of that story a little bit mixed up, but the line that I keep coming back to, and I forget who says it, it might be Mr. Tumnus, it might be Mr. Beaver. Who knows? But that's why you should go read the book. That's why I should go read the book again. It's been a while. But the line that I keep coming back to is, once a king or queen of Narnia, always a king or queen of Narnia. And I'm not entirely sure. I think that can be interpreted in a couple of different ways. But when I think about it, I know that there are times when we look at our lives, our human lives here upon this earth. And for most of us, I don't think we really think of ourselves in royal terms. I don't think we think of our lives in terms of king or queen. You know, those are not ideas that we use anymore. Those are, you know, different time, different place. But I think when we come back to this story, this creation story, we can see that it is how God envisions us, or at least it is how God envisions our role upon this earth. And I don't, and when I say king or queen, I'm not talking about a self-important person or a person of one particular lineage who happens to have all the wealth and power in a certain land and, you know, is able to wield power, you know, or, you know, act all haughty and elitist or anything. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a person. I'm talking about people who are aware that God has created them to function in a way that brings good order, that is able to restore order, that is able to bless those around them. And I think this idea of being a king or queen is a king or queen of creation is an idea that can really wake us up if we are sleepily struggling with who it is God has called us to be. I think this is a kind of a, I think ultimately it is an idea that we really come to appreciate the more and more we look at Jesus, because of course when we get into the New Testament, of course, Jesus is framed for us as the one true king whose function is to help restore humankind's identity. And it is by looking at his royal identity or his royal image or the work that he did as the victorious king that we learn what our role is supposed to be. The role of a king or queen, the role of God's royal representative who helps to bring restoration to those who are broken. And so, coming back to this text in Genesis 1, this is the origin of that imagery. This is the origin of our human identity. Kings and queens of creation, God's royal representatives. I think that is an idea that can really help our hearts in this season as we, right now we're just a few days away from Resurrection Sunday. And I think that is an idea that a lot of us might need to ponder on as we try to figure out who we are or who we are in Christ or who God is calling us to be. Genesis 1 shows us what that looks like all along. We bear the image of God. Our behavior bears or projects forth the image of God. So at the end of Genesis chapter 1, the text concludes with God looking over everything that he has made or infused with function, and God sees that it was indeed very good. And it's not just the end of the sixth day, it is the conclusion of this grand creation project that God has been giving shape to. And we'll get into more details in an upcoming episode, but for now, this is framed as a serene moment where the Creator God looks over all creation, looks over you and I, and enjoys the overall potential goodness of it all. So, thank you very much for joining me today on this episode of the Wayward Podcast. I hope you have a wonderful day. I hope you have an encouraging and uplifting Passion Week. I hope that as we move towards Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Resurrection Sunday, I hope that you hear the voice of Jesus calling you to become a reflection of him. Thank you for joining me today here on the Wayward Podcast, where the word paves the way. Have a great day.
This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long.